Well, friends, I want you to know today you're going to hear good news. You're going to hear good news today. We're in a series where we're talking about how God does improbable things, and we're saying those are wonders. And we just feel like around here, if there's anybody who's running toward Jesus, whenever they get a vision of their life that's bigger than what they thought it would be, when there are marriages that get reconciled, that is good news, and that is a wonder. And that's what Jesus is in the business of doing. And so we're going to be talking about that all through this series. You know, what makes something a wonder? What makes something wonderful? Really, it's the utter improbability of the thing. That's why we wonder at it, because it's improbable for it to happen. You know, it is utterly improbable that Cincinnati would be a city that is transformed by the love of Jesus, but we actually think that's what he's doing in our city. And we're going to spend a whole week talking about that in this series. It is improbable, just the story of Jesus, the fact that this peasant that lived 2,000 years ago has had such an impact on the world. We're going to be talking about that in another week of this series. So, but I want you to know, today and next week, we're talking about, I believe, the greatest wonders that we could ever talk about, the greatest miracles, and it's actually the people sitting next to you. I don't know if you know this or not, but you're surrounded by people in this space who have had utterly improbable experiences of freedom, of hope, of redemption as they have come into relationship with Jesus. And that's what we're talking about. Specifically today, we're talking about the wonder of freedom. And if you're going to understand Crossroads, if you're going to understand what this place is about, then you need to know this. We exist so that you can experience freedom beyond what you ever thought imaginable, because we believe that's why Jesus came. And so everything we do, everything we do is pointed at that direction. This is kind of a verse that anchors us around here. It's 2 Corinthians 3:17, and it says, "Now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom." Wherever Jesus is working, freedom is happening. And it is happening all around. It is utterly improbable, some of the freedom stories that you're going to hear today. But I tell you what, it is totally possible, because where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. And that freedom is possible for you. So today you're going to be hearing three stories of improbable freedom. And we're going to start with a story from my friend Rob Seddon. Actually, we want this to be a dialogue. We want this to be a conversation. So I want you guys to tweet your questions in as you listen to Rob, and later as you listen to Don. As you hear these stories, I want you to tweet your questions in. And at the end, we'll have some Q&A time to just dialogue with these guys about what they've experienced, the freedom. But we're going to start with my friend Rob. Rob leads our South Africa initiative around Crossroads. And he's going to tell us some stories of freedom he's seen over there, but also a powerful story of the freedom that's been brought into his own life. So let's welcome up my friend Rob Seddon.
All right. Good morning. Good morning. Let me tell you about the most recent wonder I've seen, and that is yesterday, 1,500 volunteers showed up for the inaugural family meal pack. Yeah, across four sites, we packed, in one morning, we packed 300,000 meals to feed orphans and vulnerable children in South Africa. And I promise you, next year, this event's going to get bigger. So get ready. We're talking about 1 million meals. We'll see if that happens. I'm not promising that. We'll see. My first trip to South Africa was in 2005, and I was part of one of the first volunteer team to go over. We were trying to figure out what our engagement was over there, and so we really didn't know what we were getting ourselves into. So the flight to South Africa is 16 hours. So you take that, and you land, you're tired, you're exhausted, you're disoriented, right? The first thing we do, never been to Africa, the very first thing we do, the pastor who's hosting us takes us to a funeral. A man had died of AIDS, and this pastor was doing the funeral. He was doing a lot at the time, so he takes us to the funeral. So we walk up to the funeral. Here's a picture of it. And in my head, the music stops. Everybody's staring at us and thinking, who brought the white people, right? Like, I just hear it happening, right? It's incredibly awkward. I'm like, what is going on? We do the funeral, and then after the funeral, we go to, it is tradition in South Africa where the family hosts a big community gathering. So we go to the house, and there are hundreds of people at the house, right? The street is packed with people. And to make it even more awkward, they usher us into the house, and they have saved seats for us right by the food. Right? We are like honored guests at this funeral for this man we never met. And it's just really awkward. So when it's over, I'm standing outside with a couple people from the team, and the father of the man who died, the host, comes up to us. And he's had a really bad day, obviously, but he's got a little bit of a smile on his face, and he says hello, and he looks at me, and he grabs my arms, right, like this. He grabs my arms, and he says, I love Americans. And then he moves his hands to my man boobs, and he says, you're so big. And he walks away. Yeah. The guy next to me says, dude, you just got felt up by the dead guy's dad. Like, oh, I know. I felt it. I know. So how do I end up in that situation, right? So how does that happen? So they asked me to tell a little bit of my story. And I'll tell you, it's a little intimidating to tell my story. It's tough because as I think back, I do not have that one moment in my life, that miraculous moment, right? That magical moment, right? I have never talked to an angel. I have never hit rock bottom where God pulls me up, dusts me off, and says, go get him, right? I've never had that moment. I think of the movie Shawshank Redemption, right, where he's kind of like this, right? That has never happened to me. And it's made me wonder, you know, is God really working in my life? It's a question I've asked many times. But as I've looked back these last 2 weeks, I knew I was going to be doing this talk, and I was thinking a lot about, you know, kind of what's happened in my life. And I see a parallel to a story in the Bible. And, you know, Jesus had 12, kind of a core team of 12 guys, 12 disciples, who followed him around and worked with him for 3 years. And the first two that he calls are Andrew and Simon. And Andrew and Simon are Jewish fishermen, all right? And all the evidence we have suggests that they were pretty good at it. They had a business, they had partners, they had a house. So they were Jewish fishermen, and if you think about it, they were destined to live the lives of Jewish fishermen, right? Whatever that was, they were on this path of Jewish fishermen. I'm sure their families and their children were also going to be Jewish fishermen, and it may have been a very comfortable life for them, right? But they were going to live that life because the culture said, this is who you are, until Jesus shows up. And Jesus says, follow me, and they immediately give up everything and follow him, and all of a sudden, this path, they go like this, right? So Simon ends up getting a new name, Peter, right? And not only do they walk around with Jesus for 3 years and see amazing things happen, but Peter ends up becoming the leader of hundreds, if not thousands, of followers of Jesus. He's going toe-to-toe with the authorities of the day, and he ends up in Rome, which my guess is a Jewish fisherman probably doesn't end up in Rome, right? But because they gave up everything to follow Jesus, they saw amazing things happen that were way outside what a Jewish fisherman should be. And I think I've had a lot of similar things happen in my life. The difference being that they gave up everything immediately, and I've been giving up little bits and pieces over a very long period of time and holding on to some of them with clenched fists, right? But as I have, I've seen amazing things. So a little bit about me. I grew up in small town, northern Ohio, a town called Ashland, Ohio. This is Cleveland Browns country, so I know how to suffer well. This is now LeBron James country again, so that is a wonder, yeah. Ashland, Ohio, we have a sign at the exit on the highway that says, World Headquarters of Nice People, right? That's the place I come from. That's self-proclaimed, so we are also the world headquarters of humble people, obviously. But, you know, great small town, come from a good family, great parents. I was talented enough to do okay in school and do well in sports and, you know, friends and girlfriends, and end up going to a good university, had a lot of opportunities to travel, things like that. But I look back at my life, and no matter what decisions I made, I was going to live the life of a small-town Ohio American boy, right? That was the path I was on, and the culture said, this is who you are, and this is the life you're going to live, until I started giving up bits and pieces to follow Jesus, and things have exploded. That small-town Ohio American boy has now been to South Africa 28 times, with more coming. Right, some of those trips have been amazing, and some have really been not fun at all. But I've seen incredible things happen, and I want to tell you about a couple of those. But first, why South Africa? People often ask, you know, Crossroads has been working in South Africa since 2004, so people wonder why South Africa. And the short answer is, South Africa has been called the most unequal country in the world. There is incredible beauty in South Africa. There's incredible wealth in South Africa, but there's also incredible pain and incredible poverty. And the reason is pretty obvious. South Africa endured decades of brutal race-based oppression called apartheid. And when apartheid ended, they had kind of the double whammy of the AIDS epidemic, right? South Africa has one of the highest HIV prevalences in the world. Those two things combined destroy lives, absolutely destroy lives. And there are people living in bondage because of those. Now, political freedom came to South Africa in the early 90s. You know, Nelson Mandela was released from prison. People got to vote. People voted him president. And that in itself is a wonder from God. But just because you have political freedom does not mean that you have total freedom. And the effects of apartheid and AIDS together, as I said, have destroyed people's lives and put people in bondage. And Crossroads is working in South Africa to help people get free. That's what we're doing. One story I'll tell you, a little boy named Kekla. Kekla is being cared for by an organization called the Topsy Foundation, which is one of our main partners over there. That's who's going to receive the family meal pack food. They care for orphans and vulnerable children in South Africa. And they told us about Kekla. I don't know how old Kekla is, but he's a young boy who's HIV positive. He's lost both of his parents, and he lives with relatives. And they said Kekla used to be a very energetic, happy little boy. But when he went on the medication for his HIV, something happened. They don't know exactly what. And Kekla retreated to this incredibly dark place. He got just cut off emotionally. He wouldn't interact. He would just kind of look down like this. You know, just something happened with Kekla, and it was not good. And that's the Kekla we met when we first met him. And the first time we went, there was a girl named Jen on our team, and she was just drawn to Kekla. So she spent some time with him, and at the end of our time, the ladies from Topsy asked Jen to pray for Kekla. She had never prayed out loud in her life, but she said, I'll pray for Kekla. So she does, right? And she gets this hug. Well, you saw the picture. She got this hug from Kekla. That was the first step, right? So a couple months later, another team goes back, and three women on our team in particular are also drawn to Kekla. So they're spending time with Kekla, they're praying with Kekla, and they start to see little glimpses of this boy that we heard about that we haven't seen. One day they're leaving, and Kekla comes running outside, and he tackles one of the women laughing, right? There he was. We saw that little boy, but then he would retreat back to that dark place again. So the next day, we had a dental clinic going, and we have some amazing dentists who do just incredible work, and Kekla, all of his teeth were rotten. So you can imagine the pain that he would feel when he would try to eat, right? So they had to remove his teeth. And they said, listen, we will do this, but the best way to do this is to get him to the hospital where they can put him under with proper anesthesia and they can take out his teeth. Because Kekla didn't know what was going on. He was completely freaked out. He was screaming and yelling. Our dentists are amazing. They're like, we'll do this, but there was probably a better way to do this. And it was at that moment when I walked into the dental clinic. It was my only time in the dental clinic that whole week. I had just gotten to South Africa the night before. As it turns out, I was the only person in the world with the authority and the knowledge to say, all right, Crossroads is going to pay for Kekla to go to the hospital so we can do this the right way, so there's no more trauma in this little boy's life. So we do that. We sent Kekla to the hospital. He had the surgery. They took out his teeth, and it went great. We heard great reports. So a couple months later, another team comes back. They go to see Kekla, and all of a sudden, this little boy, there he is. This happy little boy emerged, and that dark place had pretty much disappeared. It was incredible. So just this last week, I talked to Elizabeth, the woman who runs Topsy, and I asked her, I said, you know, I'm going to talk about Kekla. How's he doing? She told me, he's doing incredible, and she sent me this picture of Kekla just this week. That is freedom. Freedom breaking through for this little boy, right? Jesus using us and using Topsy to help freedom break through for this little boy. Now, another story I'll share is about a guy named Bill, who is a part of our community. Bill grew up Catholic. He had been at Crossroads for about 4 years when he went on our most recent trip to South Africa just earlier this year. And Bill would tell you that he was a believer in Jesus, but he had a lot of doubts. He really would overanalyze everything. And because of that, he was just absolutely stuck. There wasn't a lot happening in his life faith-wise. Well, Bill finds himself standing in a shack in an incredibly rough part of South Africa, right? And he's with a couple of women from one of our partners, Grace Bible Church. And in this shack is a very sick elderly man who's laying on the floor. They have to pick the man up and put him in his chair, right? And they're talking to this man. They brought him some food, and they are they're praying with this man. And through a translator, Bill hears this man say, "I want to follow Jesus." And Bill's thinking through his head. He's like, if this man in this situation can publicly say, "I want to follow Jesus," what is my problem? What's holding me back? Well, it just so happens that night we're doing baptisms in the hotel pool. So Bill jumps in the water and gets baptized. And he'll tell you that his faith exploded after that moment, that he has a boldness now that he never thought possible. I saw Bill leading a group at the family meal pack yesterday, and it was just awesome. And he'll say that, he'll tell you he's not a perfect person by any means, but the world does not seem as overwhelming to Bill as it once did. And on our trips to South Africa, we've had over 240 baptisms that we've seen. And every single one of those is an absolute wonder from God, a freedom breaking through. Yeah. But the biggest wonder I've seen, honestly, is in my own life. And I told you about small-town Ohio American Rob, right? And let me tell you about him a little bit more. Small-town Ohio American Rob was obsessed with self-help books. I wanted to be a good person. So I would read every single book that would come out, right? Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Anybody remember the Celestine Prophecy? All those different books, right? I would read them all. The problem is multiple books come out every single week, right? So I would have to keep reading these books to keep up, right? And it was bondage. It was absolute bondage trying to figure out how to be a good person. Well, I decided at one point, you know what? I'm going to start turning things over to Jesus, and I'm just going to try to do what he tells me to do. All that went away. It was incredibly freeing for me. I still read books like that, but I found freedom from all of that when I just said, you know what? I'm going to turn that over to Jesus. Small town Ohio American Rob probably would have gotten married, I assume, and would have had good years, would have had bad years, would have had good days and bad days. But the Rob who follows Jesus has been married for 7 years to Allison. This is a picture of me baptizing her in South Africa. And the truth is, and I can say this because she's not here, I'm a very crappy husband at times. I fail miserably. And a couple weeks ago, we had one of those weeks where we were just not getting along at all. We were not seeing eye to eye. There was incredible tension in our home. But the reality is, because I've turned our marriage over to Jesus, that doesn't take me down anymore. The anxiety and stress from that does not take me down, because I know deep down that our relationship is based on something much deeper than the fact that we just like each other that week or not. And that's been incredibly freeing for us in our marriage. Small town Ohio Rob probably would have had kids and would have obsessed over being a good dad and not wanting to screw up my kids. Right? Good luck, right? The Rob who follows Jesus has two kids, London and Annabelle, age 4 and 2. And they're both born on the same day, 2 years apart. That's a wonder. The wonder is going to be pulling off an 8-year-old and 10-year-old birthday party at the same time. We'll figure that out. But I still want to be a good dad, and I try hard to be a good dad, but the reality is I screw up all the time, and I'm a bad dad. But deep down I know these girls have a savior, and it's not me. And that is incredibly freeing for me. Every night I ask London questions before she goes to bed, and one of the questions I ask her is, who loves you more than anyone? And her answer is Jesus. And I say, who else loves you? She says, Mommy, Daddy, and Annabelle. I met Jesus in my late 20s, here at Crossroads, actually, when we met back at Clark Montessori School. They met Jesus when they were age 4 and 2. They're light years ahead of me, and I'm not worried about them at all. And then I'll tell you, small-town Ohio American Rob would have been obsessed with success and also security, not screwing up things financially. Well, the Rob who follows Jesus, just 2 years ago, my wife felt deeply that God was calling her to leave her full-time job to have freedom to spend more time with our girls. The day she quit, 50% of our salary walked out the door. And my salary was not enough to cover just the set bills we had, not including things like food, right? So it was a little intimidating, but we said, this is what we're going to do. Right after she did that, this box showed up at my desk, anonymous. Inside this box were 24 $100 bills. I still, to this day, do not know who sent us this box. I'm convinced it's someone in this community who did that, but I'm also convinced that God used that person to remind us that he wants freedom for us and that he's got our back on that. And we look at this box all the time, and it is incredibly reassuring for us to know that that's what God wants for us and that's what we need to be pursuing in our lives. So I'll just end with this. You know, just as I've seen with Kekla, with Bill, and with myself, right, that God wants freedom for us, that even though small-town Ohio American Rob is in me, and I really like a lot of that, that there is so much bigger that he has for us, as long as we're willing to receive it and say, I'll let you be in control. And not only is that true for Kekla, Bill, and myself, but it's true for every single person in this room. God wants freedom for you, and it is possible. I've seen it. Thank you.
So who can't relate to small-town Ohio American Rob? I mean, we all have these places, and that box is really a powerful image for me, Rob. I think about the fact that, you know, there's places where I've probably boxed in the freedom that Jesus has for me and said, well, I can't be in this place. And it's in those places. You know, I can tell you as a person who's known Rob for 12 years, I have seen him just become more and more free in Jesus. You know what? And if you never go back to South Africa, I tell you what, the freedom he's experienced in Jesus is worth all of that. And that's what Jesus has for you. Improbable, but utterly possible for you. We're going to hear another story of freedom. And this guy, Todd, finds freedom in a very unlikely place. We're going to watch his video in a moment. And while we do that, we're going to have a chance to be generous. And around here, we invest in the call to freedom that Jesus has on all of us. And so when we give around here, it's to be a part of what Jesus is doing to set people free in our community, to set people free in our city, and to set people free literally around the world. And so if you want to engage and be generous at this time, you can do that three ways. You can do it, volunteers are going to come down with some bags in a moment, discs with the bag hanging from it. You can give cash or check that way. You can give electronically at crossroads.net/give for your smartphone, or crossroads.net, you can set up recurring e-giving. And for us, as we watch this video, we're going to take a listen to Todd's story, because Todd found freedom in an unlikely place, Mumbai, India. And then after Todd's story, you're going to be hearing from Don Jarrett, who leads our justice work in India and in other places there.
I remember early on in my life, we lived in a neighborhood, and there was something on the news or something about a child that had been kidnapped, I guess, close to our neighborhood. And I was probably 5 or 6 years old. And from that moment in time, like, I would never let my little sister out of my sight. Like, if we went outside to play, my mom would always say, don't let your sister out of your sight. A child was kidnapped. That's carried on. Even to this day, I still fight against that. But that was kind of the beginning of the worry for me, even as a young kid. Fear for me, especially when I met my wife, was anytime she went on a business trip, I would literally, like, not eat for a couple days because I was afraid she was gonna get some kind of physical harm, what happened to her. So it just was an over-consuming, I could just describe it as a horrible feeling. Like, it consumed my day, worrying about my wife being on a bus to a work event or being on the airplane, being in the airport. And also around money too. I would say personal safety and money. Fear of money, checking my bank account 15 times a day, when obviously I did realize later that it only changes once a day. But I would check it 15 times a day just to see, are we gonna have enough money for this? Are we gonna have enough money for that? One day my wife we were sitting in service, and there was a little blurb about Go Mumbai, a trip. And I believe at the time it was the first one we had gone on. And she's sitting there and she's like, I think I'm gonna go on this trip. And I'm like, I'm not, I don't want to. And then especially when she told me how much it cost, it was pretty much a double no for me. She basically just told me, she was like, I'm going to go. I'd love to have you go with me, but if you're not going to go, then I'll find a friend who will go with me. So that was the first time it was like, I actually went on the trip because of fear, because I didn't want my wife to go by herself. So it's kind of strange how God worked. He used the thing that I was worried about to actually get me to go on the trip, and that trip ended up changing my life. Interestingly enough, leading up to the trip, I don't know how many folks remember, but there were terrorist attacks in Mumbai about 2 months before we left. And that was the first time that I wrestled with it. Like, I think 200 people were killed, and supposedly they were targeting Westerners. So, of course, I had Fox News on, and I'm watching this on TV. I call my wife. I was like, we'll give the money back. We're not going. Like, it's not a safe place. And she basically just told me, like, just turn the TV off. Don't watch the TV. And she's like, I'm still going. So that was the first time where I was like scared to death to do something that I actually did. So when we went over there, once you're in a different place like that, you realize very quickly that things are not in your control. So if you try and grasp onto control of specifically your personal safety, you'll drive yourself crazy. You won't make it. So throughout the first part of that week, it was just kind of I didn't know I was doing it consciously, but just kind of releasing and putting things in God's hands. At the end of the trip, there was a situation in one of the aftercare homes where it was by far the most powerful day of my life. This young lady who was in the aftercare home, and I had actually, at the end of the day, I started crying. And this girl came up to me and she wiped the tears away from my eyes and she was like, you know, it's okay, Todd. Don't worry about it. Everything's going to be okay. And I had this feeling like at the time, like I definitely felt like something came into my body supernaturally. And I had this feeling like I'd never felt before. And I didn't even know at the time how to process that. But leaving India, when I brought it back, every time I would get into a situation of like fear for either my safety, my wife's safety, finances, there's always this little voice in the back of my head, and it came through this girl's voice, like basically, don't worry about it, everything's gonna be okay. And I never heard that before, I believe, because I was never in a posture of being open to listening to it. And what I learned was throughout my life, the common theme was I'd always kind of hold things close to me instead of releasing them. But once I started taking that posture of just surrendering and like having a posture of open hands, I had no idea what it looked like, but I was just like, I'm not sure how this thing works, but I'm just going to open myself up, and God, I would love for you to come and talk to me. As time goes on, like I get these, how I describe it, very simple, is a nudge. Like if I'm in a situation where I start to feel fear creeping in, whether it's finances, like we're not going to have enough money to put this into this account, and we just had a kid, and how are we going to deal with that? I just kind of put myself in that posture, and I always get, when I feel like it's God talking to me, I always get that sense of, hey, don't worry about this. I got it covered. Everything's going to be okay. Just keep following me and we'll do this thing.
Isn't that awesome? Todd Bretz is a friend of mine. He really has been transformed. His life is very different. And he and his wife, Katie, have been back to India twice since this video was shot. His life has been transformed in a lot of ways. My name's Don Jarrett. I'm the director of Justice Projects and the work that Crossroads does in India, which means that I have the privilege of being able to interact with Crossroads' key partners to try to bring about the end of sex trafficking in the nation of India. When I talk about sex trafficking, I'm actually talking about slavery. I'm not talking about an unfair labor practice. I'm not talking about an analog to slavery. I'm talking about actual slavery. I'm talking about people who are a little bit stronger, who take advantage through violence of people who are a little bit weaker, and take away from the weak their life and their liberty and the things that they hold dear. It's estimated, it depends on who you ask, slavery, trafficking is an illegal criminal enterprise, so it's not easy to get statistics on this, but 10 to 30 million is a pretty common estimate of the number of slaves in the world today. And in fact, in the United States, I think the estimate is between 15 to 17,000 people are trafficked into the United States every year. In India, the world's largest democracy, an organization called Walk Free just published some statistics where they're estimating that half the world's slaves are living in India today. So this is the work that you and I get to be engaged in. And I'm still a little jet lagged. I just got back on Friday from India where I had a chance to spend time with our partners there, particularly Freeset, headed by Carrie Hilton. There's some hoo-hoos for Freeset. Carrie Hilton spoke from this stage not too long ago. Freeset operates a factory in the heart of the enormous Sonagachi red light area. Sonagachi is one of the largest, if not the largest, red light area in the entire world. And there in the midst of that very dark place is a factory. And this factory produces jute or burlap conference bags and t-shirts. And the people who are working in that factory are about 180 women who no longer work on the line in Sonagachi, no longer work in prostitution, because now they have an economic opportunity that despite the horror of what happened to them, of being put into that place, they now can walk out. And so I was able to spend some time with Carrie and with his staff, helping them to get to know Crossroads, which is not an easy thing to do. Crossroads is not normal. Explaining what it's like working with Brian Tome on a regular basis. Again, not normal. But it was very encouraging to spend time with them and with Crossroads' other partners as well. In Mumbai, we work with Jeevan Adhar, which has transitional homes for girls who have aged out of the government aftercare homes and who now are getting life skills and education and a job and being prepared to reintegrate into society. And in Calcutta, we are partnering with what is fairly... there goes my microphone. Uh-oh. Fairly well known as probably the most high-quality aftercare home in India, which is Mahima. And they're about to open up a second aftercare home for minors. On August 9th, Mahima 2 will be opened, which is very exciting. Of course, you know, it's easy to talk about sort of programs and successes along those lines, but for me, the most encouraging thing about visiting India and the most encouraging thing about the work that we get to do is the transformation of individual girls and individual ladies who their lives are not how anyone would have predicted that they would have turned out. The ugliness and horror that they've been exposed to is a thing of the past. And so we see girls in Mumbai and Calcutta who are getting their high school diplomas and who are going to college and who are getting married and having babies and who are reintegrating in society. We have one girl from Mumbai who's actually working in another aftercare home now as a professional social worker. So it's a beautiful thing, and it's very encouraging to see that transformation. That's what this is all about. You know, Jesus talked about the beauty and the power that comes about when we allow, when we say to God, your will be done, your kingdom come, right? When we see his kingdom brought to bear on a broken and upside down world, which gets turned right side up again. Jesus described this a lot in the things that he said. In the Bible, in Matthew chapter 13, here's one description that Jesus gives, and this is what he says. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure buried in a field. And when a man found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy went out and sold all that he had and bought that field, right? So first understand, this is not a primer in real estate acquisition techniques. This is not a late night Carlton Sheets sort of course on getting rich quick. But it is interesting that Jesus sort of puts that little detail of he hid it again, right? Jesus is not talking about if you're good, you get this. He's just talking about, man, this kingdom of heaven, this is powerful stuff. This is something that you want. This is something that is a treasure. This is the offer that changes everything. For us who live in this world, the idea that this kingdom of heaven could be something for us, that could come into our lives, man, it's worth everything I've got. And in the story, the person who sells everything they have doesn't do it grudgingly. This is a person who sells their house and their boat and their motorcycle and their car and cashes in their 401k and sells the shoes on their feet and with hands shaking takes all the money to the real estate office and just is saying, God, please don't let this land have been sold yet. Please let me have a chance for this. See, that's the kingdom of heaven. That's what Jesus is talking about. And the really interesting thing is the very next thing that Jesus says after this parable, he talks about the kingdom of heaven again. And Jesus is really, really smart. And he never gives us sort of throwaway lines that we can sort of use and abuse at will. He makes us think. Watch what he does in the next part of this passage. Matthew chapter 13, 45 through 46. He says, again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it. Sounds a lot like the first passage, right? But there's a very fundamental difference between the two. Jesus in the second passage doesn't say that the kingdom of heaven is like a pearl. Look at it again. He says the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant
looking for fine pearls. And that's a very, very different thing. See, what do you have to be a merchant? Well, one thing you have to have is some experience. You have to be able to tell the difference between an ordinary pearl and one of value, right? Because you're looking for value. You're looking for a pearl that has been overlooked by people in the marketplace. You're looking past things that hide or obscure the value of this precious pearl. You're looking for something that has a hidden value that the world doesn't see. Does that sound familiar? Right? Because that's what God does with these girls. He sees pearls of great price that the world has said have no value whatsoever, but he sees it. And isn't it funny that you and I, as we join God in what he's doing in these girls' lives, we get to see it too. And so the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. And the transformation is not just the treasure that I get to have for me, but the treasure that I get to have as I desire the transformation of others. In the first parable, the kingdom of heaven is a treasure. And in the second, the kingdom of heaven is a treasure hunter, right? And this transformation is what it's all about. It is the offer that changes everything. As I think about the kingdom of heaven, and as I think about these two parables, it reminds me in a personal way of a girl that I know and that I was privileged by God to be able to be involved in the life of, a woman, young woman named Mala. And, Mala was a target of rescue for my team when I worked for International Justice Mission, one of our key partners in India. An International Justice Mission sends investigators into the red light areas looking for the presence of children, teams of lawyers and social workers to advocate for them once they're rescued. And we rescued together a lot of girls. And every brothel is a horrible, ugly place, I promise. But the brothel that Mala was in, and I've talked about this from the stage before, was a particularly ugly place. It was the most violent brothel that we had ever seen. And one of the reasons why was because the men who owned and worked in the brothel carried large wooden clubs. And they did not hesitate to use these clubs on the women and children in this place. And I will not burden you with the stories of what went on in there. I will only tell you that Mala saw her best friend beaten to death in front of her with one of those wooden clubs. And, you know, it took us seven attempts to rescue Mala. Now, just know this, before I went to India, I was working as a narcotics prosecutor, and I was a guy who, you know, pretty gung-ho, kind of an adrenaline junkie, and I was sort of known for compulsive over-preparation of cases, and I was really masking a lot of my own hurt, a lot of my own insecurity, and my own anger and fear with trying to achieve and trying to have success and trying to be in control of everything. And this process of going through the attempts to rescue Mala was kind of a very painful surgery for me because I did not have control over this situation. Again and again, we sent our men into this place, and I was really worried that somebody was going to get killed, and I really was worried that we were never going to get her or anyone else out of this place. Eventually, we did. About 10,000 people were praying for this rescue, and through a series of circumstances that really were highly, highly improbable, we were able to retrieve Mala and others, and the owner of the brothel, Nakul Bera, was arrested. And I want to talk to you about one of the improbable things that happened as a result of this rescue that's maybe not what you expect, and that is the improbable change that took place in my own life. Because, the truth is, I've told the story of Mala before many times, actually. And I had a secret for a long time when I told the story. And the secret was that I would talk about Mala, and inside I really didn't feel much joy or really any joy. I would think about the story, and I would just remember the horror of what she and the others went through. I would remember the fear that was involved in these months and months it took. And I would remember what Mala was like after we got her out. Brian's talked about this before, but Mala's body language after her rescue was really, really disturbing. She would bend over, sort of hunched over in her seat, with her shoulders down and her head really, really down. And she would only look up sort of through her eyebrows. I mean, it was so sad and so disturbing. And I understood why. It's just that I wouldn't have articulated it, but what I thought when I saw Mala was, you know, this is as good as it's going to get for her. She's never going to have a normal life. She's never going to recover. I'm sure glad that she's not being abused anymore, but the damage has just been done, and she is not going to recover. And that was just really sad. But you know, God was at work at this kingdom of heaven, bringing it to bear when I wasn't around. And things were going on that I didn't know about until about a year and a half ago when I was in Calcutta visiting. And I was with some friends, and they were taking me to lunch. And they had an ulterior motive in taking me to lunch, but I didn't know what it was. We went to this little cafe not far from the IJM office. And, you know, it was lunchtime, and it was sort of one of those, you know, situations where you go into the restaurant at lunch, and it's obviously they are completely and totally overwhelmed. I mean, they don't have enough waitresses. You know, you ordered tuna 45 minutes ago, and here comes your chicken. The waitresses are running around, and you know, they forgot things and sent things you didn't even ask for, and you just have to smile and kind of go with it, which is fine. And as I'm sitting there having my lunch, I'm noticing that one of the two waitresses is just sort of running around, but she's keeping sort of her equanimity about the whole thing. She's got a sense of humor. She has this 10,000-watt smile that just lights up every once in a while, and she's just an attractive Bengali college student doing a job that, you know, or the age of a college student, doing the job that someone of that age would do. And as I looked at her, I studied her, and I thought, oh my goodness, that's Mala. And I physically was stunned as I sat in that chair. It took me probably 30 seconds to process it. I never believed that I would see that. But you know, the truth is that God was saying something to me. As I took time to process it, I realized God was saying, you know what? I've got this. I'm good. I'm good. You know, if God can heal Mala, then there is no one and there is no circumstance that is too dark and too beyond hope for God to intervene in, none whatsoever. And even in my own heart, and even in my own underestimation of the goodness and power of God. And then just a week later, I was back in the States, and we received news that Nakul Behra had been, in fact, convicted of trafficking Mala, along with four other of his men. Sentenced to 10 years in prison, and now they will not be able to do this to others. And for Mala to be able to hear from the Indian government, from a judge, an official, that, you know what? What happened to you was wrong. You didn't deserve this. It makes all the difference in the world. You know, Mala, that day when I saw her in the restaurant, she was talking. She said, I'm an IJM girl. She had a big smile on her face. Everything was different. And this kingdom of heaven has come in her life, and in many ways in my life, in ways that never would have happened if I hadn't walked through what I walked through. And I want to tell you, that kingdom of heaven is available to you and to me today turning our broken and upside down worlds right side up again. God longs to give us that transformation. And I would encourage you, just jump in to the deep end of the pool. Give God a chance to show up when it doesn't seem like he can. Experience this kingdom of heaven, this precious pearl, like Todd has, like I have. Thank you. Thanks, Chuck.
Well, I told you guys you're going to hear some good news today. Thank you guys for just sharing freedom, what you've experienced. We got a lot of questions, and so we'll jump right in, try to get to as many as we can. One of the questions came up is, how are we defining freedom? And I would tell you that freedom, as we're defining it, is the ability to do God's will. That's what freedom is. God is infinitely good. He's infinitely perfect. The Bible says that the way of God is the way that leads to life. And so anything in our life that keeps us away from him is not freedom. And anything in our life that puts us deeply in dependence on him is actually freedom. It's this counterintuitive thing where this freedom begins when you surrender to Jesus, when you surrender to God and understand that it's not an independent life that we need, but we need a life in dependence on him. And one person actually created a Twitter account with Rob's face, called it Small Town Rob. Somebody's been working really hard in this service to do that. But they ask a really good question, which is, what's the first step we can take to get out of our predetermined lives? So I'd love for you guys to both take a stab at that question.
Well, Small Town Rob. the first step is you have to be willing to limit your choices, which is counterintuitive, right? We think freedom is just having an abundance of choices. But I found that kind of unrestrained choice is probably the biggest enemy of freedom. And just think about it this way. If I send you to buy a loaf of bread at the grocery store, that's one of the most paralyzing things you can possibly do, right? Because there are all kinds of different choices. And, just being willing to say, you know what, God, I'm just going to let you define my choices. All of a sudden, you see things just explode in your life. That's what's happened to me. That's what has happened to many, many people I know. So it's counterintuitive, but being willing to limit your options and not keep everything open so you can move with the wind, I think is the first step towards really finding freedom.
I think that, God does the opposite of the law of diminishing returns, right? We have an enemy. He's really into the law of diminishing returns, where you get something up front, and then the good starts going away, and the bad starts increasing, right? I think the heroin problem is a pretty good example of that. God wants us to dive in and trust him, being willing to go through the scary stuff, being willing to jump into the deep end of the pool and give him a chance to show up. And when you do that, those are the kinds of prayers that God loves to answer, where you've done everything you can, you're out of options, and then God gets the credit because you know who arrived, you know who showed up.
Yeah, that's good. Couple questions around local trafficking and recognizing that there's a lot of trafficking, sex trafficking even, that happens in Ohio, in this area. So talk a little bit about how we're engaging in the work locally, even as we're engaging in India.
Well, it's interesting. So this question has come up a couple of times now. Cincinnati is becoming this sort of a strange mecca of anti-trafficking folks. I'm not sure exactly why, but there are a lot of people from a lot of different organizations who are settling in Cincinnati. We've been getting together on Friday mornings. We're sort of on a break right now, but a lot of the people who are interested in anti-trafficking work both abroad and at home have been getting together, and so I do anticipate we'll be engaging more deeply with this. We do have the All-Star Game, the Major League Baseball All-Star Game, coming to Cincinnati next year, and we know that with that, you get guys who think that prostitution is entertainment, and they don't realize that it's actually exploitation. So we do look forward to continuing to go deeper with local trafficking issues.
Yeah. Why don't you both just talk to a couple questions about what's next? What's next in South Africa? What's next in India? And particularly for folks here today, how can they get engaged?
Yeah. Well, South Africa, we are still developing three different partnerships over there. And one of the things that's exciting that we're talking about is building a CityLink Center-like project in South Africa with one of our partners, Grace Bible Church, because that is what's needed over there, is employment and entrepreneurship and things like that. So that's going to be awesome. We're sending 45,000 pounds of food tomorrow to South Africa, which is awesome. Yeah. And 2015, believe me, there are going to be all kinds of trip opportunities. So just pay attention in here. And you, every last one of you is invited to go. Not at the same time.
You're going to take all of them?
Not at the same time, but over the next decade, you can all go.
That's good.
In India, you know, the Freeset partnership is really interesting. We already have a lot of people who are in the entrepreneurial field, the business field, who are helping, you know, Freeset with messaging and branding and marketing and all kinds of stuff like that. There's more opportunities coming. We have started eWizKids, which is a tutoring program for girls in the aftercare homes, teaching English as a second language. That's kind of a big deal.
It is. And just to clarify, that tutoring is happening. People are in Cincinnati.
Through the internets, yeah. The webs.
Yeah. There. Which is kind of a big deal.
It's kind of, I've heard that's a big deal.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of trips going, a lot of people doing training over there. We had a child protection group that went over, and I mean, we were literally turning people away from train the trainers kind of a delivery over in Mumbai, and it just, there's a lot of cool stuff happening. It's going to continue.
That's awesome. You know, we could talk about this all day, guys, because just the stories you tell are so encouraging and inspiring, and what's most inspiring is your stories, what God has done in you. Let's just thank these guys for being with us. Thanks. Well, Jesus said this in John 8:36. So if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. And I hope you see today that this freedom is available for you. This is the kind of freedom that Jesus brings. The freedom, the ability to do God's will, to live life as God intended, to live not an independent life, but to live independence on Jesus. It's available, man, and it's wonderfully good when you receive it. And just know, everything we do around here at Crossroads is pointed at that. It's pointed at freedom. It pointed at the freedom that God has for all of us. Let me just pray as we close out our time. God, I just pray that for all of us, we would sense and feel the very personal invitation you give us to be free. God, if we need a new definition of freedom, if we've been defining freedom poorly, I pray that you would change our minds. I pray that you would help us to understand that the most free place that we could be is in the center of your will and under the authority of Jesus, because he loves us, he died for us, and he has the power to give us a life of freedom. God, I thank you that your freedom reaches Kekla in South Africa, that your freedom reaches Mala in India, and I thank you that it reaches people right here in Cincinnati, Ohio. Thank you for being a God who is for our freedom. In Jesus' name, amen. You guys are dismissed. We'll see you next week.